It's not every day you run across somebody who can take the story of Santa Claus and improve upon it, but William Joyce did just that, not just for Santa Claus, but the Easter Bunny and the Tooth Fairy and more, in his series of books, The Guardians of Childhood. We had so much fun talking to William last year, we jumped at the chance to have him back, especially since he's got a new book out, a memoir of sorts called Billy's Booger. It features William's tale of his first book when he was Little Billy, and the original small book is reproduced within its pages. If the name doesn't ring a bell, William Joyce makes films and apps and books. He's been involved in the Toy Story movies, won Emmy Awards for the TV series Roly Poly Oly, and an Oscar for his short film, The Fantastic Flying Books of Mr. Morris Lessmore. We established last year that this is not the William Joyce who was the Nazi propaganda agent known as Lord Haw Haw during World War II. And William Joyce, great to have you back.
Well, thank you, Jeff. Thank you for destroying the myth that I had an alternate doppelganger who was a terrible Nazi. I really appreciate that.
So many William Joyces we could take into account here. This is great. Your drawing of Little Billy spread out by the Sunday Funnies in the book Billy's Booger reminds me that the pictures used to be really big. I mean, can kids today be inspired in the way that you were?
I hope so. I mean, this book is. Despite its, you know, the bluntness of its title, you know, Billy's Booger, though the entire title is Billy's Booger, a memoir, sorta. It's like a nostalgic celebration of the childhood I had in the 60s. And a lot of that had to do with how awesome the newspapers were and how things have changed so much. The book starts out with the line, "Once upon a time, when TV was in black and white and there were only three channels, and when kids didn't have playdates, they just roamed free in the out-of-doors, there lived a kid named Billy." I mean, you read that to a kid now, and that sounds as, you know, as once upon a time far away as when knights rode, you know, their steeds and wizards did their wizarding. I mean, it's like, you know, it's very interesting to talk to a kid at this point and say, you know, TV used to go off at night. And they're like, well, why? Was it tired?
Right. They play the Star Spangled Banner and go to bed. What?
Right. And so the funny paper is coming every day. I've had, you know, I have this animation studio, Moonbot Studios, here in Louisiana. And a lot of our Moonbots, our employees, will ask me, like, "So are you, like, into comics?" I'm like, "Yeah, they used to come to my doorstep every day, you know?" I mean, and they're kind of like, "Huh?" And I'm like, "That's what newspapers were." I mean, none of them get newspapers now, so they don't know that it still happens. It's just that they're a lot smaller and a little less wild range or free range, I guess you'd say.
Well, and the kids themselves, this idea of the free range kids, I mean, I you know, now that you jog my memory, I mean, I was riding trains into New York City from the Long Island suburbs when I was about 8 years old, and parents get arrested for letting their kids do that these days.
I know. I read about that woman who started the free range child movement, whose kids left to go to the park without their cards that explained they were free range children. And yeah, they got arrested, and it is like evidently the statistics are that our kids are safer now than they've ever been. And if you were to leave your child unattended, you know, in your front yard, someone did, you know, the numbers, how long it would take for them to actually have something bad happen, to be kidnapped or something like that. Do you have a guess of what it might be, Jeff?
How long they'd have to wait for a bad thing to happen?
Yeah.
I don't know, 3 weeks?
750,000 years.
This is some interesting research.
I know. I mean, yeah. So your kid's okay, for the most part, on average. And so I guess at this point in my career, I wanted to look back a bit, because I'm always asked, what was your first book? Mm-hmm. And I've done 50-something of them now, and 6 movies and all this other stuff that I've been doing. But the question I get asked most often is, what was the first? And the truth is, it was, you know, this book I wrote in the fourth grade called Billy's Booger, and it was a contest to see what kid could write the best kid's book. And I loved telling stories, and I loved drawing pictures, and so this seemed like, you know, like, heaven sent as an assignment for me. And because I mean, I didn't even like the regular sports that we played. I always tried to make up new sports. And so I thought I kind of had it in the bag. I mean, I tried it out on some of my classmates, and it merged. So the teacher said, write about what you know. So what I knew was, you know, science fiction, comic books, and the fact that I was crummy at math. So Billy's Booger is about a kid named, you know, Billy, who is crummy at math, and he gets hit in the head by a meteorite, and he and his boogers get superpowers, and now they can do amazing math and fight crime all over the place. And so, you know, I thought, I did it all in green crayon and green pen, and but I got sent to the principal's office. I didn't win. And but later, and I was crushed, you know, at this development, and had to promise not to draw boogers in school anymore. But the librarian told me later, she could see how bummed out I was, and she was like, you know, we put all the book entries in the library. You have your own library book now, and yours is checked out the most, Bill. And that kind of like went, whoa, okay. And that began my career.
A success after all. Billy's Booger, the memoir of a little green nose buddy, is the original book, Billy's Booger, a memoir. I'm a change in the title there, is the adult version of that. We're talking to William Joyce on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back from this break and talk more with him, and you can join us if you'd like. Phone number and email address on the way. First, a break. William Joyce and you on the Jefferson Exchange resumes in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is William Joyce, the creator of more than 50 books, 6 movies, all kinds of apps and other great stuff along the way, including the Guardians of Childhood book series, which led to the rise of the Guardians movie series. Well, actually, it's just one movie so far, but we're hoping it's a series. We'll talk to William about that. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Now that I've broached the subject, I might as well get right to it. Is there going to be a sequel to the Rise of the Guardians movie?
You know, I don't know. DreamWorks has gone through a tough time, and the movie made, God, in the economics of Hollywood, they made $300 million worldwide, and that wasn't quite enough.
That's $300 million is a failure, right?
Yeah. Or it was initially seen as a failure. Now it's sort of everybody's lightening up a little bit, and it's just, you know, what can you say? I mean, I love the movie. I thought it turned out very well and worked very hard on it for a long time. And I do hope they do some more of them, because I've got a lot more stories in that series I'd like to tell, and people seem to love it. So
I still remember sitting in my own living room watching Rise of the Guardians about a year or two ago, and one of the neighborhood kids, about 16 or 17 at the time, could not remove himself from the couch.
Awesome! That's exactly.
I mean, the other kids were like, come on, Louie, let's go. And he's like, no, dudes, wait.
Well, you've made my day. Thank you, Jeff.
Oh, pleasure. So speaking of school and being younger, I mean, give us a sense of what, I mean, outside of creating books like Billy's Booger when you were a kid, what was school like for you day to day?
You know, I felt like, I think it was a really good experience in a certain way, and that it taught me how to exist under a totalitarian regime. I mean, I was a daydreaming kid, and I think the thing that saved me, I think, is that just about every teacher I had saw that underneath that mischievous mind there was, you know, something of value, maybe. You know, there are talents at work that could be hopefully focused. And even in the Billy's Booger book and in the real life, you know, what happened to me, I mean, the principal did give me a talking to, but at the same time, I could tell he was sort of amused, you know. And so, if it weren't for my own, you know, adventurous sort of imagination, and then the tolerance and occasional acceptance of some of the authority figures that I had along the way, I don't think the connective tissue to become an author and a filmmaker would have occurred. So it's sort of luck and happenstance and a goofy mix of mischief, mayhem, and forgiveness.
Did the principal really call you his most challenging student?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Calvin Dunlop. Yes. He drove a Corvette. We thought he was very cool.
So what were you supposed to do with that information, though, at what, 8, 9 years old or something?
Which information is that?
The Corvette. No, the information that you're the most challenging student. What are you supposed to do with that?
Well, you know, I thought that was good. I mean, he didn't say, you're an awful kid. He said, you're one of my most challenging students. And I was like, oh, that sounded like an honor to me.
Were there notes sent home with you or stuff like that?
Oh, yeah, there were notes sent home. Some of them are in the book. And the thing that kind of brought this book back into my forethoughts was I went and asked for my permanent school records, you know, the ones that they always threaten you with.
Your permanent record, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like, there's some, like, vision of the Secret Service that was studying every kid or something, and that, you know, all your transgressions, mostly it seemed like, would be put down in some sort of, you know, life-altering form that would follow you for the rest of your life. And, like, you know, in the third grade, you threw rolls, you know, that kind of thing. And so I found out where to get them. It was you go up to your old high school, and if they haven't thrown them out, then they're somewhere in storage. And they're different from your transcripts, evidently. And it's the stuff the teacher said about you year to year. And I expected this to be several boxes.
Right.
And it's 3 sheets of paper that's in a folder. And on each sheet of paper, they had room enough for, like, 3 years, right? So you'd have, like, first grade, second grade, third grade on one page, and that was the extent of your documentation. And there is room enough for maybe 3 or 4 sentences for the teacher to evaluate you as a human being and student. And the fourth grade, my teacher had only 2 words to describe our year together, and she said, odd child. And stapled to her section was the book, was Billy's Booger, as you know, sort of exhibit A for the prosecution. So I hadn't seen it since, you know, back then.
You didn't have a copy of your own?
No, there was only one, you know.
Oh, sure.
And she'd taken it out of the library. It had a little library number and everything on it from, you know, when it was being checked out. And there it was again, and beat up pretty bad. It was all on manila paper. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, here it is. Because I've been telling this story for a long time, since I first got started. But this was the first book I did, but now I had it back in my hands. And so I was like, I want to tell this story, and I want to tell the story of how it came to be and how I came to be standing here with, you know, odd child, you know,
right,
in my hands. But that it turned out okay, you know, like, you know, that I ended up not going to prison, and I had a career, you know, of some, if not note, not, I haven't, you know, gone to prison or anything. So I went back in time, you know, and researched this thing within an inch of its life, and got the cars right and the bike right, and looked at all my old family photos as much as I could, and did the best job I could of parroting comic strips from back then. So instead of Peanuts that you see, you know, Billy reading in the Sunday papers, you see Wee Garbanzos.
I saw that, Garbanzos instead of Peanuts. That was great.
And so this is pretty much facsimile in the middle of the book. There is, you know, it leads up to my writing the book and my excitement about writing the book, and then it says the name of this book, and then inserted in the middle of the book in a smaller format on manila paper, exactly like the stuff that you had when you're a kid back then. and then Green Crayon is a facsimile of the original book, the most of which was kind of destroyed in our garage fire a few years ago. And I've got about three pages of it that are still readable. But, you know, between fire and water, it took a beating.
Huh.
And but I had Xeroxes of it from before that. So I was able to pretty much recreate almost exactly. I did spell things a little better a couple of times, but I did leave in some of the misspellings because they amused me.
So, I mean, is this like being an inker for some other pencil artist? You know, you're going back over your own work from when you were just a wee
yeah,
guy?
Yeah, exactly. I'm trying to draw crummy, you know? And it came profoundly easily. I was kind of shocked by that. But, you know, it just tickled me, man. I mean, it's pure fourth grade silliness. I mean, Billy's superpowers include, you know, chocolate ray vision. You know, he can make anything that tastes bad, like, you know, green peas, taste like chocolate. So, I mean, I'm like, I just went, this is pretty good stuff, you know?
It is that. William Joyce is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We're laughing about his book, Billy's Booger, a memoir, sorta, which contains within its pages the original Billy's Booger, the story he wrote in fourth grade, which was then called The Memoir of a Little Green Nose Buddy. William Joyce, if the name doesn't ring a bell, created the Guardians of Childhood book series, the Fantastic Flying Books of Morris Lessmore, Roly Poly Oly on TV, you know, all sorts of stuff, including the Toy Story movie series as well. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we visit with William at 800-838-3760 around the listening area. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So the original Billy's Booger, the uh-huh. book within a book, I mean, it indicates a sense of humor beyond your years even then, assuming you've reproduced it faithfully. Like the boogers noticing that you'd been biting your nails.
The teacher said, write what you know.
So tell us about your parents' sense of humor. I'm just curious to know about the family from which this sprang.
You know, they were very supportive, but very bewildered. And they were country people. I mean, they both pretty much got to go to college. They were the first people in their families to go to college because of being in World War II and because of the GI Bill. And so... And all my sisters and my cousins were all, I was the youngest. They all went to Juilliard and Columbia and all these places and became opera singers and actors and playwrights and photographers and painters. And I came along kind of towards the end of all that. And it was like they were sort of used to it by then, but they're still like, we don't know what happened. We went from being sharecroppers to raising, you know, concert pianists. And
it was a meteor.
It must have been. Thank you. Oh my God, it was right there in front of me. But a snake had bit me. And so, you know, literally, I mean, you know, at this point, like, one of my sisters had been living in Greenwich Village, a couple of my cousins had, and they came back, and they were, you know, they're basically beatniks. You know, this is pre even hippie. And, you know, so when I'm doing this, they're just like going, well, this is reasonably tame, you know. So they took it very well. I remember the meeting with the principal, and he was explaining, you know, maybe it's not the best thing that I'm drawing boogers in school that have superpowers. You know, everybody else did puppies and unicorns. And, my mom said, oh, don't worry about it. You know, Principal Dunlop, you should see the stuff he draws at home. And and she was right, man. I mean, I had some really awesome pictures of dinosaurs eating my sisters. And the bridge club would come in and, you know, want to see what Bill's drawing. And, you know, they're expecting, like, cowboys and Indians. And they'd have all these, just, you know, aliens with melting people and you know, cannibals eating, you know, hunters and all this kind of stuff. And they're just like, oh.
How nice.
Exactly.
But the family,
you know, there was a little bit of, like, the principal wasn't just coming out of nowhere when he, you know, got into this, because I'd been drawing caricatures of dinosaurs eating, you know, our least favorite teachers, and those have been, you know, absconded and taken up. And so, I mean, you know, it was like, okay, look, you draw well. Let's try to just go into another direction a little bit here. But that was difficult to, you know, I was like, well, what? And then I started having art lessons, like real art lessons. So I did still lifes and landscapes and things like that. But I kept wanting to put monsters in them and wanting to put UFOs in them. And so the funny thing is, as an adult, that's what I do. And now I'm getting paid for that and you know, making movies because of those. The weird things I made up back then have turned out to be, you know, my success as an adult.
William Joyce is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. You got some serious art instruction at some point, but it sounds like you didn't stick with it for long, or just decided not to finish it out.
No, you know, I had lessons for years and years, and I went to art school for one semester in college, and I really had become a pretty good realistic painter by then. And so when I went to art school, they were like, they wanted me to abstract. I'm like, you know, I did that when I was four. I really want to learn realism. And they're like, well, realism is dead. And I'm like, well, really? I mean, was that declared? I mean,
who brought that edict down? Yeah.
Is there legislation that states that? I mean, I'd like to draw realism, and be it surreal or not. And there was kind of, you find this a lot in art schools, there's sort of intractability of, you know, this tyranny of current thought. And so I changed to film studies after that first semester, and I neglected to tell my father. And so he was a little bewildered when I graduated, and he came to the broadcast film department for me to get my diploma. And he was like, God, it took me so long to get used to the idea of an artist, but no, film?
Can you go to something where there's even less guarantee of a good income?
That's what he wasn't sure about. He goes, is there a better way? I mean, do you have any more chance to make money at that? I'm like, I don't know, Dad.
All right, so back to Little Billy. I'm curious to know if you think, you know, based on the way times have changed and the attitudes about kids, if you think maybe you would have been put on Ritalin if you lived in today's world.
Oh, my God, I think about that all the time. Like, what would that mean? I mean, I wasn't a hyper kid. I was just sort of marching to a different drummer. Maybe a rather loud one. So I don't know. Like, I don't know. And I find that kind of alarming. And when our kids were growing up, there were a number of times when, you know, different things were suggested. And I'm like, I don't see it, you know. And my kids turned out fine. So we were free-range parenting before it became called free-range parenting, and we caught some grief for that, but nothing bad ever happened, and we didn't give our kids a tenth of the freedom that we'd had as kids. I mean, literally, we would roam all over town and be gone all day. I mean, on the summers, it was like you're out the door, and you knew to get back around dark, and they never knew where you were. They kind of knew where you were. Sometimes they knew where you were, but it wasn't. The only time you got in trouble is if you were just late for dinner. And the idea of letting your kids just go and run like that and explore and learn stuff, learn life, seems as far away as King Arthur's time now. I don't know.
Despite the stuff that kids, I mean, they always seem to have screens in front of them now and being entertained, but it doesn't necessarily mean they can't create on those devices too. So, I mean, do you, with your own kids or with the kids that hang around them, do you see them at least being creative in other ways?
I think that the exposure to all these things has made them, you know, in many ways very, very clever. They're savvy. They're pop culture savvy. And that doesn't give you, there's not, that's not a perfect connotation, but it is I find them amusing to speak to. Like, they're not just these blank-eyed dullards who, you know, zap their brains into these screens. I mean, they find interesting stuff. They find things that interest them. There's so many little eddies into that world that you can find your own particular eccentric entertainments, and that's what they tend to gravitate towards. And so the stuff I see that they show me is usually extremely clever and very, you know, entertaining. So I don't think they're just handing over their brains and letting them turn to jello. I think that they're getting a lot of interesting stimulation there.
Good to know. We have much more to talk about with William Joyce. His latest book is called Billy's Booger, a memoir, sorta, which includes the original Billy's Booger from when he was in the fourth grade. Back with William Joyce and you on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is William Joyce. We seem to have him every June, at least for these last 2 years, and very glad to have him here as well. He's the creator of the Guardians of Childhood book series, the fantastic flying books of Mr. Morris Lessmore, Roly Poly Oly. I mean, you name it. He's written more than 50 books, been involved with 6 movies, won an Oscar, won an Emmy. And he's the author of another book for kids that adults can enjoy very much, too. It's called Billy's Booger, a memoir, which contains the younger self version of Billy's Booger written for a book contest in the fourth grade. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange if you have questions or comments or stories you'd like to share. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So a lot of admissions
here. Okay, Jeff, you sound flummoxed.
Well, it's because I'm forced to admit a few things because of the stuff that you bring up in your own work. I mean, I too thought I was going to gain superpowers from a meteorite. Mine was going to have a bolt of lightning too. But okay. To find somebody else on the planet Earth who wanted to be adopted by Mrs. Peel from the Avengers.
Oh, my God! Oh, my God, yes! I had that same thing. I wanted Mrs. Peel and James Bond to come take me.
I would have been happy with John Steed as my father, but, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that would have been cool. I mean, he'd be like a good uncle.
So it's just amazing the ways in which our minds can move. But you were able to turn this into a career. I mean, you're really one of the few of the proud, aren't you?
Well, let's say I'm one of the few and the slippery enough to get away with it.
So then talk about the process. I mean, you created Moonbot Studios, and I assume what that means you have great creative control over your work. And before Moonbot, though, did you have to make a bunch of concessions in moving characters from books to screens, that sort of thing?
Sure. I mean, look, and it will always be the case. I mean, making movies costs so much money. And when you get... a film studio to go, oh yes, we want to spend, you know, $150 million on your story and your world, they're going to have concerns and they're going to want to have input onto how that money's spent. Who wouldn't? But the atmosphere that works under can sometimes take some of the fun stuff out and smooth out some of the eccentric, you know, curly cues and the rough edges that made everybody excited about the idea in the first place. And so every filmmaker faces that, and everyone I've worked with, I mean, I worked with Francis Coppola and, you know, John Lasseter and a number of different, you know, extraordinarily talented filmmakers, and kind of learned my apprenticeship under some of the best, you know, that you could learn under. And all of them have to compromise, and they compromise every day. Coppola told me he was happy if he got 40% of what he wanted on the screen. But that was a good day.
Yeah.
And it's just costs so much money, and it does. It's not all the time that the studio's interfering. It's the magic of what you're hoping, the alchemy that needs to happen. It's hard to make it happen. I mean, casting is very important. Timing is very important. And the decisions that you make over the course of making a film, you know, there's millions of them. And it only takes a handful of them to be not quite right to sort of start a chain reaction within there that kind of diminishes things. But then there's times when it all goes right, and you can never predict what that's going to be and how that's going to go. I mean, Casablanca should have been a disaster. They were making it up as they went along. Same thing with Gone with the Wind. They'd started filming Gone with the Wind before they even cast Scarlett O'Hara.
All right.
So it's luck and alchemy and determination and intellect, and all sorts of things go into making a film work out great. Now that I have my own studio, along with my partners Brandon Oldenburg and Lampton Enoch, we have a better chance of doing it the way we want to do it, but that doesn't guarantee it's going to be better. We hope so. I mean, our first short won the Academy Award, and many of the things we've done since then, we've won 5 Emmys in the last 2 years, and the books keep getting, you know, praised, and the apps we've done have been awarded for all kinds of awards I've never heard of. So it's this independence seems to be working, but, you know, there will be a reckoning, I have a feeling, that at a certain point when we go to make a feature, which is what we're planning to do now, it's going to be hard. Making movies is hard. And sometimes when Orson Welles had all the freedom in the world 2 times to make a feature film, the first we all know about, Citizen Kane, and the second, The Trial, which he made in 1960 based on Kafka's book, you know, people don't see that very often, and it's a difficult, and I would even say almost impossible to watch, unpleasant film. It has all of his adventurousness and craft, and it's riveting in places, but it's also, and purposely he made it as difficult as he could for the viewer. So it doesn't mean having all the freedom in the world doesn't mean it's going to be popular or succeed, but it is an awesome feeling to have that. And if you keep your head about you, you've got a good shot at making something people will embrace.
William Joyce is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. So when you think about the people who have to, you know, do all the business office stuff, approvals of movies and things like that, as you kind of come back to the vision of Mr. Dunlap, I mean, a guy you liked, but that he was, you know, maybe you want to try doing this instead.
I wish him well. Look, he did me a good turn, and he didn't really come down hard on me. I think he just sort of felt like he had to give me like a gentle nudge. Mm-hmm. And I remember it vividly enough that I didn't feel like I was in trouble. I just felt like, I don't know, it's like he felt like he needed to do something, but he wasn't entirely sure what that was, and that it would probably work out. So,
all right. So, no particular comparisons to the studio execs. You know, I did talk to someone recently who said she didn't realize until she took part in the process that kids' films are made on a couple different levels. So, kids can appreciate them in one way, and adults can appreciate them in another. I mean, I have to believe that's deliberate, because it's not just a byproduct, is it, of adults making stuff that won't bore them to tears?
Well, I mean, all right, if you talk down to kids, they hate it, and they'll know it. And so that's important to realize. So in not talking down to them, you put things in there that are maybe a little outside of their understanding and reach, but they will know what those things are, and they will be interested in those things. And it starts, to me, so much of growing up and watching movies was I was trying to figure out the grown-up world from what I was seeing. And now, it's not a very realistic way to try to figure out what the grown-up world is going to be like to watch a James Bond movie, but it gives you some indication of what goes on. And you get some things wrong. I mean, like, it's just always like, James Bond, man, why does he hang out with all those girls that just, they you know, they end up, they take naps together, but I don't know. Like,
and then he doesn't talk to them again.
Yes. And they got shot. scenes later, they try to kill him. And so I'm like, I don't know. If you take a nap with a girl when they try to kill you, I don't know. But I guess what I'm saying is, like, the best, and I don't even like to call them children's films, but the best films that are have sort of fantasy elements in them are ones that are very mature. I mean, in many ways. The Wizard of Oz has a lot of adult concerns in it and is, you know, not for the faint of heart. But it resonates and it speaks to the grown-up and the child and the grown-up. So if you just go with something like totally child-centric, you end up with Smurfs. And, you know, and I'm nothing against Smurfs. I mean, I think silliness has its place, but I'm kind of interested in something that resonates a little bit more some of the time. I mean, this is a guy who just did a book called Billy's Booger, and he's given the Smurfs grief. Okay.
Well, it's green where they were blue, you know, that kind of
thing. There you go. Both cool colors, one's a tertiary, one's a secondary. No, primary and secondary. Wow. Look, it's the Star Wars movies. Who are they for? You know, kids adore them, grown-ups adore them. There's something in there that's appealing on both levels. And exclude one and you lose the other. I mean, it's just part of the way you try to tell the story. You tell the story of King Arthur, and if you do it, you know, in the mature fashion, like the Once and Future King, T.S. White, that's something that will rivet a kid until the day he dies, and a grown-up will read and weep copiously for just the poignancy of it. So I guess that's what I'm trying to do. And even in Billy's Booger, I mean, there is a certain poignant quality to this. And there, it's about a lost time, and it's a very nostalgic piece. And I had a great time thinking about sort of making this a cross between, I don't know, Mad Men and Dennis the Menace and the Avengers in a way.
I'm glad you brought up Dennis the Menace because, you know, the father figure looks like Dennis the Menace's father.
Well, and exactly like my father. And the mom is dead on my mom. The sister is dead on my sister. It's like all these things are there. But, you know, then a librarian does something kind of nice for him. And that's the thing. It's like growing up is made up oftentimes of small kindnesses and small defeats and small heartbreaks. And so this one is about a series of small heartbreaks and small triumphs that ended up adding up to something.
Well, you know, the heartbreak, I've been sitting here with the book open to the It Was a Long Walk Home two-page spread.
Yeah.
After Billy realizes he didn't win any of the prizes for entering Billy's Booger in the school book contest. I talk about Billy as the third person. It's you, I know. But I mean, so the Billy character is all the way off in the corner of the page kicking something down the sidewalk. And it's you feel the emptiness. You feel the loneliness.
And that's the way I felt that day.
Yeah, it's really compelling stuff.
Thank you very much. I mean, thank you for noticing, because I mean, there's a lot of thought that goes into these books, even though they're picture books, and sometimes people treat them as sort of a subspecies of literature. But at their best, which is what I try to do, is you put as much thought into it as you can to make the reader feel something.
So I've wondered this off and on since the last time we talked a year ago, just looking at the different ways, like with New Yorker covers and stuff, that you've represented Superman and as Nicholas Saint North and the Rise of the Guardians with the Russian accent and everything, that if there's a character you're still sort of salivating for the copyright to lapse on so you can really go to town with them, like what would you do with Superman or Mickey Mouse or I don't know, whatever pops into your mind?
Well, let me see. What a bank of riches there. Whoa. Oh, gosh. I'd love to do something with King Kong. I'd love to do something with Johnny Quest.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. Johnny Quest there was sort of Johnny Quest in the front of the book. Like,
yeah, that's right.
Like the garbanzos for the peanuts here, yeah.
Right. That's Johnny Trek.
That's right.
Quest. But that even goes back to, what's his name? Not Jack Armstrong, the All-American Boy.
Tom Swift? No.
The kid that always had gadgets and figured chunk out.
Okay.
Darn it. it was the same guy that did like the Bobbsey Twins and
Let's see, Bobbsey Twins. Let me look that up while we're talking here.
And funny, now we can look stuff up while we're sitting there trying to get stumped for only a moment.
Right. There's no stumping anymore, right?
Yeah, which is kind of awesome.
Yeah.
Like, you can't sit there forever going, this is going to drive me crazy if I can't remember it. But
So Laura Lee Hope was the pseudonym. Edward Stratemeyer, the...
Stratemeyer. Yeah, okay. Stratemeyer did all those things. He did Nancy Drew, and he did this kid. Darn it.
All right, looks like we're stuck on that one. But okay. Something like
Johnny
Quest. Precursor
to Johnny Quest. Yeah. So I loved it, Johnny Quest. I'm really psyched about the Man from U.N.C.L.E. movie that's coming out.
Oh,
they
right
set
yeah
it in the 60s, which is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
I want to do a monster movie, like a really great, crummy monster movie. And that we're talking about making a movie out of Billy's Booger, out of the End Papers, where he's made up all these new superheroes like uh-huh Bert the Pancake Lad.
And, oh, right. And Captain Immaturity.
Captain Immaturity.
There's all kinds of great stuff in there. You know, even if you buy it for a kid as a present, make sure you read it yourself first. Billy's Booger, a memoir, sort of contains the original Billy's Booger from when William Joyce himself was 9 years old. William, thanks so much for joining us again on The Exchange.
Jeff, it was great talking to you again. We'll see you soon.
All right, take care. And that'll do it for today's Exchange. Our producer is Emily Curitan. At the controls today is associate producer Soleil Rowan, thanks so much for joining us today. Listen to us next time on The Exchange. Sorry about the problems with the first hour. Listen again tonight or find it online. Have a great day.